So, Dave, have you been having vivid dreams during lockdown?
This is a very personal question. What do you mean vivid? What is a vivid? Wait, what's happening? What's a vivid dream?
I've had a few wicked dreams. I've had one or two Brazzers dreams, but never a vivid dream. No, what, vivid dreams, that, don't worry. I'll tell you later. Vivid dreams are when you dream really intensely and remember all of the details once you've woken up. So, like, oh, most of the dreams that you had last night, you don't remember, do you?
No. I don't.
But National Geographic has a very interesting article going around, and this has happened for me, that the stress of the coronavirus pandemic and the global lockdown has been causing a lot of people to report that that stress is, and this is a biological thing, a lot of stress causes you to have vivid dreams because your subconscious is working out all of that stress.
Right. So wait, so because you're in a sort of fight or flight response mode, your brain registers what it's dreaming about better in the waking moments? Or
I'm not sure if it's...
Brad, I'm coming to you for science, Brad. You're failing
me here,
Brad.
You know darn well not to come to me for science. No, but what the stories in National Geographic said was that this stress causes you to dream very intensely to the extent that a lot of times you wake up in the middle of the night as a result of the dream, and you like I said, you remember all these details. And a lot of people across the globe are reporting vivid dreams.
Well, now I specifically want to step into the Brad Geiger dream world. What are these for you in these moments of stress? Are these nightmares? Are they pleasant or
no.
are they just weird?
They're just bizarre. They're weird. I've had a couple of them. In fact, I had one last night that I'm just reaching for as we speak. But the one that really got the whole thing started was my wife brought it up. She says, "Have you been having dreams, like really intense dreams?" I go, "Oh my God! Last night I was bowling with a bunch of old ladies on the old ladies' league, and I was having a great time. But there was this one old lady down the lane at the end of every time she'd get done and reset the pins manually. And this was pissing me off because, listen, I grew up in Bad Axe, Michigan. Bowling is like a second religion. When you went to high school, you had your SBATs. That was your SATs and your bowling average. Bowling's very important. And she was walking down this lane to reset the pins manually. So finally I got pissed off and I just started, she was down there, I just started bowling. And if she got out of the way, fine. And if not, then she was going to get hit. The bikers who were hiding behind the lane in with the pin setting equipment, the like Harley Davidson bikers got very upset at this, brought their chairs out and sat in a row across the bowling alley.
There's a lot to unpack here. First, I can't let it go unsaid that this is now the third dream that you've mentioned on the show where old ladies figure key in your dream world. What is it with you and older ladies, like grandmotherly age or eight ladies? What's going on there? There's some weird Freudian stuff going on there that I'm not sure about.
There really is, because the Golden Girls keep popping up. You know, I honestly don't know. Listen, how many times have I told on myself? I tell you, if it was a thing, I have no idea where this is coming from. Huh. And the other one, now I'm taking it, you don't have any vivid dreams.
I would be lying if I said I've never had them, but because now that you've described them, that absolutely has occurred to me. But not at this moment. This moment, what's better described is me going, "All right, time to go to bed." And then I mistakenly read the news before bed. And then I stay up till 3 a.m. going, "Oh, God. We're all going to die.
Oh, God. People are out there protesting because they want a haircut.
By the way, that to me seems like all the future winners of the Darwin Award is like,
your lips to God's ears.
Those people 4 weeks from now, that situation takes care of itself. You know what I mean? That's
If you follow what's been popping up on my social media, it's already happening. Like, there's already been a couple of deaths where people were just like, then they go back and they show their social media, and like a few days ago they're out there, this is all a hoax, this is horrible, and then the next day their family is running a GoFundMe for their funeral.
It is weird to see evolution at work.
Yeah.
This is literally, the dumb humans are getting culled from the herd. Like, just like the slow antelope.
Yeah. You know you're in trouble when you are the slow antelope.
So, Brad, if I go, you know I was the slow antelope because I was like, no, I need to go get my hair cut. This is important. I'm Dave Kellett. I need to have perfect hair.
Well, I've got to share this other vivid dream because this one was really super bizarre. I was all snuggled up in a comforter, and the comforter, the top of the comforter is always a little bit extra thick.
Yeah,
it had all these little sculptures or plushies of the crab from Little Mermaid. Remember the one,
sure,
the one that sang all the calypso music?
Yeah, Sebastian.
Do, 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 do. So I pull this up, and all of a sudden I hear the music. Do, 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 and the little crabs start dancing around up and down with their little crabby claws singing along. And I was like, this is the best blanket ever.
What? What am I supposed to do with that? How do I...
I don't know. That's what I woke up saying. I said, how am I going to make this a reality? David, seaweed is always greener in somebody else's lake. You dream about going up there, but that is a big mistake.
Oh, my God. All right. On that note.
Thank God I'm not singing again.
I'm glad you did it as spoken word poetry rather than singing it, though. That's my one thanks to you as a friend. And on that note, I'm going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about Brad's vivid dreams.
And making a living, putting those vivid dreams into your comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and the cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm his friend Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So Dave, let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics, my friend. And I know we had not anticipated it, but have you ever had this happen? I've had this maybe once or twice in my entire career of 4,000 or 5,000 comics, where a dream generated a fully functioning comic strip punchline.
Yes.
And you woke up going, well, that's amazing. That works.
My work for the day is done.
Yeah, I've done. Thanks, subconscious. And like, it's only happened once every like 5 or 6 years. But you wake up and you're like, how do I make that happen every day? I want that to happen every day.
You're afraid to share that news with a civilian because then their takeaway is, you could do this job in your sleep. but the truth of the matter is, how many times has the opposite ended happened where you have this dream and you've in the dream, this is the perfect comic idea. This you've drawn it out. You've written the punchline. You've done the setup. This is perfect. And you wake up and you think about it. You remember it and it is unintelligible.
Oh, and it's just nonsense. It's just like, it makes sense, but it's like, it ain't funny. It's like, okay. No. And then the punchline is, but I bought the broccoli. Okay, but that's not a punchline. Why did Dream Me think that was a punchline?
Yeah, and why is the flamingo talking to the king? I don't understand this at all.
Thanks, Dream Me. Good job. Good work.
Yeah, yeah. That's usually my dream editor is coming up with just useless ideas.
That's right. Well, speaking of dreams, I should give a shout out to our dream sponsor for this show, the good folks at Wacom over at WACOM.com. Wacom, the makers of the new Wacom One. And both Brad and I have the Wacom One and the old bigger, the beautiful big Cintiqs in our studio.
Yeah.
And are huge fans. So this is literally the sponsorship made in heaven.
You know what we've seen repeatedly now, Dave?
What?
A lot of our Patreon backers are buying the Wacom One based on our comments here. And I've gotten a couple notes from people that say they love it.
Oh, that's great. We also got a note, and this is just us passing this along to Wacom. We also got a note from someone who said, like, I was going to buy the Wacom One, went to look for it, ended up buying the big, gigantic Cintiq. So it's like, all right, that's fantastic. But,
and he bought the one that I've got in my studio. It was a Cintiq 22 Pro. Whoa, that is what I'm missing. I've got to figure out a way to get back to the studio more often while we're on lockdown. But yeah, I'm missing that 22 Pro. But while I'm here, I've said it before, that Wacom One is getting me through quarantine. I don't know what I'd do without it.
It's been great. So we want to give a big shout out and thanks to the Go folks at Wacom at WACOM.com and the Wacom One. Do go check it out. $400 price point. It is great for your amateur, pro-am, and professional drawing over at Wacom. And Bradley, jumping into the show this week, I wanted you to take us through the little happenings and happenstances that are going on with Lore Olympus over at Webtoons. Because
yeah.
I came to this later than you did, and I'm amazed and shocked that this occurred. So I want to hear your thoughts on it. Can you take us through what happened?
Well, I'm gonna do my best because, and if I get any details wrong, I'm sure my listeners out there, our listeners, are going to help us out. But here's the broad strokes. Rachel Smythe does a comic called Lore Olympus, and it's a gorgeous comic.
It's so beautiful.
And it is one of the heavy hitters on Webtoons. It's one of the very top comics that is over there.
The 800-pound gorilla, yeah.
Yes. And it is a storyline-based comic that has been building up to a big reveal for years. Like, the people that follow this comic, it's been coming in for a landing, and the big reveal was about 3 weeks away. Webtoons takes an image that basically spoils the reveal and used it in a promotion or an ad to get people to sign up for this deal where they can read the comic early. So obviously most of the people reading this are reading it for free on the site, but Webtoons wanted to convert some of these people to people that were paying for the privilege of reading it early. Which is fine. They're well within their rights to do that. In fact, they need to convert a certain number of those readers into subscribers. But they unilaterally, in other words, without talking to Ms. Smythe, they unilaterally just pulled this image that spoiled everything and used it in the promotion. In other words, she had no idea that this was going to happen until she saw it staring her back in the face. On the site, her readers are upset.
Okay, well, the readers, can I ask you, though, as a cartoonist, and
yeah.
Neither you nor I know Rachel, and we've never met.
No.
But on her behalf, aren't you enraged? Like, just for like four levels of stupidity, I'm enraged for on her behalf that this happened to her. Because, A, she clearly is a master storyteller to generate the audience that she has gotten. And she knows what she's doing. She's been crafting this for years. And then to have some dumb idiot come along and be like, let's put it on social media as a way to boost our numbers by like 0.1%, by the way. Yeah, this is great. By the way, I don't even understand the logic of using the spoiler image itself to entice you to come in to read future installments early, right?
I've got an idea.
You think some 22-year-old was just given an image and...
My thought was the person went to look for an image. This image looked really good. They could tell by the way it was drawn. It was an important image and pulled it And the real crime is whomever was at Webtoons didn't feel the need to check with her first and say, hey, we're going to do a promotion based on your comic. We're going to use this image and this wording. We wanted to clear it with you first. They didn't feel any obligation to do that. They just pulled it because they run a unilateral, evidently, they run an unilateral type of operation. They didn't think to get in touch with the artist at all. They just ran it. And of course, from what I understand, and by the way, I've dropped a couple lines. If Rachel's listening, we'd love to have you on the show. We don't even need to talk about this. We can just talk about your comic and how great
the
we
work
think
is
it
so
is.
Good.
But she, from what I understand, she's furious, and it sets up a really interesting test case for something that you and I have kind of been saying about Webtoons all along. And I want to bounce that off you and see what you think.
Okay.
So here you've got a situation where this story has been really ruined for a great number of people who are reading it. But they've got another 3 weeks before this reveal is supposed to have happened. That's a magical time in storytelling. You are really ramping up that tension. There's no tension there because now they know what the reveal is going to be. That, for me, would have me packing my bags. I'd get the hell out. I would not stick with a platform that pulls that. Right. Because again, like I said before, at the heart of this is that they did not feel the obligation to get in touch with the creator when they were going to pull this promotion.
Right, like a basic decency thing.
That's a real problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, that means you're on a unilateral platform. Now, it would have me packing my bags. But what have we said about Webtoons from the beginning? You and I have always issued kind of a take it slow, use it as a mirror site at best. It may not be the greatest idea to build your audience on Webtoons. In fact, I think that was the title to one of our shows, one of our episodes, mm-hmm, should you mm-hmm. build an audience here? Now, if Rachel decides to move, will she be able to take her audience with her? Because Webtoons limits drastically the amount of outreach that you can do as a creator.
Right.
And conversely, and here's where I want you to weigh in, Dave. Conversely, if she stays on Webtoons, is it worth it?
Oh, both are really weighty questions. So first of all, I think you're right to ask the core question of, well, to me, there's like five questions to unpack here. God and I could talk about any one of them for 20 minutes. But the first one, the fundamental disrespect of the reveal says so much about that corporate structure and how they are, how they view you as a property and as an asset rather than as an actively creating creator who is telling a story of which certain story points are key moments emotionally for you and your audience and not just a selling moment, you know, right? So that's mm-hmm. different. So they're looking at numbers. They're like, this is a beautiful panel. Let's push this service. But that's the equivalent of, if Disney Plus was launching right now and this artist, George Lucas, had this big reveal of like, hey, Luke, I'm your father. And they're like, sign up for Disney Plus now and learn all about how Luke is he's your father, Luke. And you're like, wait, what? What? And George Lucas is like, no, F you. That's my big reveal. Yeah. Don't do that.
Well, yeah, we didn't see hide nor hair of Baby Yoda until that episode went out.
Right. And but what I'm getting at there is that there is a disconnect between what serves the corporation and what serves the artist. And when things are working well, there's a sort of a quiet agreement of like, well, let's meet in the middle. I can give you images that will help promote this Read It Early program. Or let's talk about how we could black out certain images within a bigger panel, right? Like if it's a character reveal, you could black out what that character is with enough, you know, ambiguity to hide who it is. Or if it's a bit of text, you reveal the panel, but you don't reveal the text itself. What I'm getting at is there's artistic ways to promote a Read It Early program, which I get that they're trying to do. That's fine. Mm-hmm. There's nothing inherently wrong with that.
Of course.
Work with your artist, have a relationship with your artist, have a peer, but clearly that's not what's happening. So that's upsetting to me. Now, to answer your bigger question of like, can Rachel potentially move off? A separate question from the contract. Of course, Rachel could move it. The question is, because she does not own and control the platform and therefore does not own and control her reach to that audience, she's probably going to be able to port 40 to 60% of her audience over to whatever the new site is, and mainly by using her own social media that she owns and controls to some extent, you know, versus Webtoons. And then you just have to hope that the rest of the audience goes, hey, where is this comic that I loved on Webtoons? Oh, I'm going to go Google it, right? You have to, you basically have to hope that the audience can find you again, right?
Right.
And that's painful.
And her Twitter feed, or her Twitter followers are legion. Like I checked out Twitter. There's a lot of people following Ms. Smythe on,
I think, by the way, it's like 400,000 or so, right? 400, almost a half million. By the way, we didn't mention this, but that last name in comics, Smythe, for those of you that remember, boy, is that a name in comics that triggers other memories, because that's Andy Capp's last name. And if these two are related, that is the most amazing synchronicity in comics I've ever heard. Because how common is the name Smythe? It can't be that common of a, I believe it's an English name, right?
I think
it's an English version of Smith, right? That you were Smithy. But anyway, Red Smythe created Andy Capp, that terrible wife-beating drunk comic.
Right.
And then the very fact that there's another cartoonist with the name Smythe blew me away. Anyway, all that is to say, tremendous social media audience. Obviously, she could port a huge number of people very quickly just by saying, hey, I'm mad enough that I'm moving the comic. Now it's over here. And you would have to hope that a lot of those people would help to amplify. But the damn truth is that someone on Webtoon, someone on GoComics, someone on Facebook doesn't wholly own and control their reach to their own audience. There's always either some algorithm limiting it, some inability to let them blog or tweet directly to them or talk directly to them. And so that is a problem for something that we have come to say as a mantra on the show, which is you have to own and control your own career. It's the same thing that friends of ours right now in DC and Marvel, who are amazing illustrators, amazing writers, who have been writing Spider-Man or Deadpool or this or that. And now they're like, what do I do? I don't have direct access to my audience. And it's heartbreaking for us because that is so, like we've said time and time again, Brad, I would rather have a super dedicated, smaller audience that I can reach and own directly, right? Like I control my access to a small core, passionate audience than a huge nebulous audience that I can't control if I can get a hold of them, you know?
Right.
What are your thoughts?
It's the game you play all the time.
Yeah, I've talked too much. Now I want to hear your thoughts. So what are you, your take on this?
I'm going to do something completely unfair because we just got done spending 15 minutes planning the show out and I'm going to throw you a complete curve because... Okay. Did you hear about the new distribution organizations that have cropped up now that Diamond has gone full stop? Speaking of what you're talking about, mainstream comics and distribution.
So I heard that DC is using a smaller regional distributors. Is that right? Do I have that fact right? Okay.
So there's two. One of them is... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no. I was going to tell you what my corporate take on that was. So not knowing at all the details... Here is my thought. DC, which has bigger corporate parents, and Marvel, which obviously has bigger corporate parents now, if they're smart, they will use and take advantage of these smaller distributors right now to get the books into stores, right? Get them in there.
Right.
And then I think what's going to happen, Brad, I can almost guarantee it, within 18, 24 months, they're going to buy those smaller distributors.
Yeah.
Because what they're doing right now is, Brad, we don't have the staff or the know-it-all or the wherewithal to make these distribution deals happen. But since we can't have Diamond anymore, these smaller distributors work. They exist. It's not going to be perfect, but they exist. But we'll use them for 6 to 12 months. We'll build them up with some additional funds to help them staff up. And then we'll just buy them and then own and control it. Don't you think?
Yeah.
I think that's what's going to happen.
That's my thoughts on that. Exactly. In other words, I think there's a lot of people out there thinking, okay, this is going to be what saves the comics industry in terms of the comic shop retailers. And I just don't, I'd like to see that happen, but there's a scalability issue of, and like one of them is basically Midtown Comics from New York City. Is stepping up and kind of becoming a quasi publisher distribution.
Are they really?
Agent.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now Midtown is big by any stretch in comics shop world, but that's interesting that they are.
Think about the amount of real estate that they've got right in the heart of Times Square. They've got to be doing well.
And also, if they truly had to temporarily clear that space so it can become a warehouse to become a transit point to points around the country and to Canada, you know?
But I'm keeping a watchful eye on that because it's an interesting development. The real question for me, and it's possible, but there's two things that's got to happen. One of them is scalability, like I just said. In terms of this being a saving grace for comics retailers, scalability, their ability to scale upwards to actually compete with Diamond. And the second one is, can they divest themselves of that direct market organization that they had? In other words, we talked about in the last show where it's really difficult for comics retailers because when they buy something from the distributor, it becomes part of their permanent stock. That's that direct market system.
Right.
if they can divest themselves from that
and aspect, go to
more of a bookstore model where if something doesn't sell, you can sell it back to the distributor and therefore the publisher. Can they approach something like that? I don't know.
I don't know that
the mindsets out there are willing to adapt to that. And I don't know that Midtone Comics as a fledgling distributor could take that on as a possible loss.
I will say this, because you know me, I think, Brad, that I've earned the ability to say this. I tend to think of myself as an optimist, right? I tend to look on the bright side of things. I tend to look at hey, how can this problem be solved? That kind of thing. In general, as a personality. And I really think that this is an unsalvageable moment for comics and for floppies. I genuinely don't see how this goes forward 2 years from now. I can't see floppies still existing. I can't see most comic book shops existing on the other end of the coronavirus. They were all barely holding on, literally barely holding on. And every year the number of shops was going down.
Yeah.
And then in the meantime, Diamond goes toes up, right? And then now you're going to be using an imperfect distribution system to get the books out to an audience that can't do walk-in traffic,
right,
who already was starting to age out of comics anyway, and a price point that wasn't working for a modern system anyway. Like, if, for example, if you were starting quote-unquote comics right now, Brad, you wouldn't start with the price point that floppies are at. Like, there's no way to get an audience with that price point. Like, no 10-year-old is like, I want to spend $5 for 30 pages, you know?
For a 30-page floppy.
Yeah.
It became prohibitive. That's one of the reasons that, and there were so many reboots, I couldn't follow the characters anymore. That was one of the reasons I got out of mainstream comics as a reader, is because it was too expensive a habit. If I took my kids down there, I was dropping $40-$50 every weekend.
Right.
And I started looking at the receipts, and I'm like, I can't afford to keep up this habit.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Cocaine would be easier.
So I this is one of those times in my life where I am pessimistic. I can't. Because I can't even game out how I would do it, how I would try to save that industry. Because that normally contributes to my optimism, as I go, well, here's what you do. You go bang, 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 and that's how you save the system. And right now I'm like, I can't see a way to save this. I don't know how you would save it. And to me, the future of comics is Lore Olympus. The future of comics is Sarah Scribbles. It's the oatmeal.
Yeah.
It's individual cartoonists who, for the most part, are charting their own career. And yes, they're using and partnering with publishers or websites or this or that. That's fine. But I think it's mostly going to be independent cartoonists. And then a couple of big corporations at the end of this that own a lot of IP that they will turn into future movies in 2025. But for the next couple of years might not be producing a lot of comic books. I don't know. Tell me that I'm wrong, Brad.
No, the sad truth is I think that you're right. Although it's definitely something to watch, something to keep your eye on if you'd like to take your mind off of world news and put your mind on something that's still related but unrelated. This is something that I'm going to be keeping a very watchful eye on as the days go forward.
And I think both Brad and I will say this. If you are a Patreon backer of the show, jump in over on the Discord server and tell us how you think the comic industry can survive. And by that, I mean the physical floppy. And so that's over at patreon.com/comiclab. What did I say? I almost pitched my Patreon, Brad.
You're so used to doing it the other way.
I know. But and then you can jump over to the link to the Discord server there. And also the comments underneath the show on Patreon are a great place to talk about it, too. But I would love to hear other people's thoughts, because I genuinely don't foresee a path out. And this is one of the rare occasions where I'm pessimistic about it. Anyway, so chime in and let us know what you think. Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute to stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, we're going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
When you do, you're going to get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And exclusive Patreon posts that go even deeper on Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, which is a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, we get it. No worries.
Yeah, listen, you can still support the show by rating us wherever you get your podcasts.
Just leave a 5-star review and a few kind words.
That, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
Now, everybody, let's talk comics. So, Brad, for the 20 years of Sheldon, I have sold the original art from that comic strip, right? There are 4,000-plus strips in that archive, and each one is drawn on archival paper with acid-free paper with archival ink and light-fast inks. So they go out, and they're nice. I actually am really proud of them. They're beautiful originals, as were yours when you did original art with Evil Ink. We're both very clean-line style. We like a clean page. Yeah. Anyway, I'm proud of selling those originals. One thing I wanted to mention, though, is that I had an idea the other day for a joke that involved attorneys, right? And it was just a simple punchline, but you're in, you're out. It was a standalone comic, and it was just about attorneys. And
what was the punchline?
The phrase was attorneys at law, right? And it was making fun of, like, why do they have to get specific with that? And yes, there are historical reasons. I know that there is an attorney as agent versus an attorney at law. But leaving that aside,
I didn't know that.
Like if I was your, if I gave you power of attorney, you would be my attorney as agent. Versus an attorney at law. But no one knows that. And so it's fun to make fun of the phrase attorney at law. Anyway, attorney long story short is I had a legitimate idea that I legitimately wanted to draw. It legitimately made me laugh. But as I'm drawing it, I go, oh, man, talk about an original that's going to sell. Like, it is like a thirst trap. When you draw a comic about a dentist or about an attorney or about a doctor, they always buy the original.
Immediately.
They're so thirsty for comics about themselves that they're like, and they're sitting on a lot of cash that they're like, yeah, sure, I'd love to buy an original, have that up in the old office.
But it's something that's perfect for them to display at the office in that waiting room, exactly.
But as I'm drawing it, I'm going, this is such a thirst trap. Like it's I don't get that sensation when I'm drawing a comic about a Starbucks coffee maker. What I mean? Like it's only with attorneys and dentists and doctors and lawyers and judges that I'm like.
But what a great way to know that you could bring in a little extra cash during the quarantine is to know that you can kind of dip back to that. Are you tempted to dip back into that well more often these days?
No, but. I guess what I was trying to say is one of the reasons why I wanted to prompt this story was by saying I legitimately got the idea. I legitimately wanted to draw it.
I remember the word legitimately coming up at least once or twice.
Now listen. I'm not so Machiavellian that I can't admit. But here's what happened. This idea came on its own. I legitimately want to draw it. But as I'm drawing it, I go, I'm in the money. Da 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 da. You know, because I knew it was going to sell.
When I was doing Evil Ink with ink, I did one. My originals never really sold very well. Not like yours, because I think part of that was like I was doing a lot of storyline stuff and you do a lot of standalone stuff. So if you buy one of your originals, you don't need to know anything when you're walking into the bathroom where they've got it hanging there. You can just enjoy it. Right. Now, with mine, it's a little different. And my originals never really sold well. Years later, they make really great Patreon rewards, but they didn't sell. But I did one comic in which there was one of the characters was at the dentist, and and there was a close up on his teeth, and there was all these little people running around. In all black outfits and black masks over their face with a little slit for their eyes. And the punchline was that this was the perils of ninjavitis. All right.
It is one of my favorite comics that you've ever done.
Sold immediately.
Of course, because it involved dentists.
This is when nothing was selling. I'm like, oh my God, I've got to do more dentist stuff. And then, of course, I couldn't get a dentist idea to save my life. Because once you've done that, what do you got? Cuspids? Can you really come up with a punchline for cuspids?
You can for bicuspids. There's a joke there.
oh, that's a good, that's a good dirty joke, too.
I can imagine a joke right away for that one. Another thing. So this is a funny moment I will share with you. Many moons ago, I sold a comic original of mine to Google, the actual company, not to an individual. And they were like, the woman who reached out was like, yeah, we're going to put it in the lobby. And so for a long time, I was like, oh, yeah, one of my comics is hanging in the lobby of Google.
Yeah.
Long story short, one of the employees that actually worked at that facility emailed me many years later, like 2 or 3 years later, and said, hey, I noticed that you mentioned that it's in the lobby of Google. Do you know where it is so I can go see it? Yeah. And I said, I haven't been to that location, so I don't know where it is. And so she proceeds to walk around the building and she goes, I found it. And I thought you would laugh at where it is. Brad, it was not in the lobby. It was like in some weird stairwell that no one uses. And hung it up over there. So in like this moment of pride and hubris, oh I was like, God. Oh, it's in the Google lobby. Yes. It's,
if you look, you'll see it in Google, especially if you're a janitor and happen to know where the mop is.
Listen, if there's a fire and you're using fire escape number 3B, you're going to see my original art.
Oh, God. Yeah, you can read it as you're running past with your head on fire.
Bo, you know what, though? I know we didn't intend to do this, but I will share one more moment about this. So speaking of thirst traps, again, many moons ago, 15, maybe almost 20 years ago, is towards the beginning of Sheldon. I, with no alternate intention, I did a comic strip about Dr. Pepper, right?
Oh.
And I don't remember. I don't even remember what the joke was. It was like 15 years ago. Anyway, Dr. Pepper then reaches out to me and goes, we love the comic strip about Dr. Pepper. Could we send you some Dr. Pepper stuff? And I was like, I'm no dummy. Yeah, send me some stuff. They sent me like 5 t-shirts. They sent me like this gift certificate that would get me like pallets of Dr. Pepper. I got Dr. Pepper jelly beans. A tiny part of me, Brad, was like, do I just start doing corporate comic strips all the time? Like tomorrow's eBay, the next day Cadillac. Come on, everybody.
I was going to say, how long does it take you to come up with a good Lexus joke?
I obviously didn't do it, but it's so funny how like they know what they're doing for the cost of a few bucks of like stupid swag. They're like they a little bit got me to consider, do I do a second joke about Dr. Pepper? I'm not sure.
Hell yes.
Anyway, so young me was a little bit swayed by swag. Old me was not so swayed, but it's funny how that can work. But anyway,
that's
beautiful. I thought you would appreciate the fact that as I'm drawing the dentist comic, I was like, well, cha-ching, you know, I'm like the Warner Brothers frog going, hello, my honey. Hello, my buddy.
One of the greatest moments in animation.
So let me ask you, while we're talking about comic strips, I wanted to ask you a serious question because I was drawing a comic strip the other day that was intended to be a 4-panel comic strip.
Yeah.
And by hook or by crook, right as I'm about to draw it, I go, wait a minute, I can make this a 3-panel comic strip. And I edited the text a little bit, mm-hmm. and I got it down to 3 panels. And as I'm drawing it, it occurred to me, 20 years into my comic strip drawing career, is it possible, Brad, that a 3-panel comic strip is inherently better in the form than a 4-panel comic strip for a comic strip? What are your thoughts?
Inherently is better. The operative word like there. In other words, automatically.
Taking away any other subjective things about which one's written better, the style that's written, what I'm getting at is just by the basis of the form, is a 3-panel inherently better than a 4-panel?
I'm very interested in hearing your thoughts on this, but I'm going to, at the risk of sounding stupid, I'm going to say that it might be, and I've got a really dumb reason for saying that. It's because it's much harder to write. And that, therefore the Catholic in me says that if it hurts more, it must be better. You know,
if like there's suffering involved, then that's how you know it's a good thing. Yeah,
like eating your vegetables. It's not nearly as fun as eating your pudding, but you know it's better.
Right.
I it's so hard for me. It's another step towards what I think is the apex of comic writing, and that is the single panel comic, which is so hard to write.
Hard to write well.
Hard to execute well. But
wait, before you move on from that, do you consider the single panel to be the apex of comics?
I kind of do.
Really? I've never heard this from you. Okay. Expand on this.
For a number of reasons, but like in terms of now, I've got to narrow it down. When you're talking humor comics, because obviously for like for long form storytelling, it's not the apex, right?
Right.
For Spider-Man, not the apex.
No.
But for humor, a single panel comic, in my opinion, is the apex for a number of reasons. Number one, it distills the process down to its essential unit, which is image, joke.
Right.
Boom,
right.
Boom.
Bang,
they work so quickly as to be indistinguishable from one another. It's got the perfect meld of what makes a funny comic funny. Secondly, It is, in terms of likability, shareability, et cetera, the things that even back in the newspaper days, they talked about the refrigerator quality of a single panel comic, because you'd cut it out and put it on your refrigerator and it would be there for the next decade. Today, what we say is that it's got viral abilities because it's much more, in the same way that we were just talking about, it's much more likely someone's going to share a single panel comic than they're going to share, a third step in a plot progression from a long form Evil Inc., right?
Right.
So in that respect, it's better. I think a single panel is superior in humor comics in almost every way. And that's why I see people who can do it like Chris Halbach, people who can do it and do it brilliantly, I'm in awe, because I do them exclusively for Patreon, but I don't hold myself to a schedule. In fact, I just did one last night that I thought was pretty good. We'll see. But I can't hold myself to a schedule because I cannot do it with any kind of regularity. It's just like every now and again, when it happens, and there you can enjoy it.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't expect it next week.
Yeah.
So in terms of that being like one step closer to a single panel, I think maybe you've got something there. What's your thoughts on that?
Wow, this has actually generated a lot of thoughts. I'm glad I brought this up because I did not know that you thought that a single panel was the sort of the be all end all of the.
Yeah.
But I guess that's a sort of logical extension of what I was saying, which is that three is better. But let's break it down, because for you, the single panel is the distillation of image and word reduced to their both their minimalist effectiveness and their virality and easy to sharedness, right? Like that's me making up words, but
that's
you get
a good
where I'm going.
One. Yeah.
So I get where you're going with that. But in your mind, then, just following the logical extension of this, I think you and I could both say that the greatest master of the single panel comic, probably Gary Larson, would you say? Or would you say
doubt.
Maybe Charles Adams?
You've got that's like, what flavor of ice cream do you like the best? But you've got to put Gary Larson in that. You've got to put Charles Adams in that. You've got to put the guy that does Speed Bump in that.
Speed Bump's very good. Yeah.
Routinely brilliant.
Yeah.
And there's also
Dan Ferraro, maybe, with Bizarro.
That's exactly the next one on my list. And there's another newspaper one that I'm blanking out on the name for, but it is routinely fantastic.
So let's unpack this, though. This is what I was getting at.
Yeah.
So does that mean for Brad Giger that you consider, or possibly consider, those four cartoonists to be the best ever?
At the best,
like, is that what you're kind of saying?
Man.
Because that's intriguing to me, if that's what you're saying.
So would I consider, for example, Gary Larson to be a better cartoonist than Bill Watterson?
Because I think we can immediately back off on this declaration of best by saying, listen, doing four panels is a very different skill set and serves a different master.
Yeah.
So for me, to add a little bit of flavor into this, I think a single panel is pure joke. It's pure concept, right?
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's what it is. It's it is the distillation of the writing and the art into a pure concept. Bang, bada bing, bada bang. You're in, you're out. It is a single concrete object. And if it's a New Yorker cartoon, they even do the favor of removing the humor from it. So then it's even more distilled. And so
I'm so glad you said that.
It's even one more step of distillation. They remove the other panels. That's great. They remove some of the writing. That's great. And then they even do you the favor of removing the humor. And then you've got the perfect comic right there.
And then as long as you're the kind of person that wants to pretend that the emperor has clothes on and that you got that joke, then you're good to go.
Yeah. So anyway, okay. But here's what I think. I think a three-panel one for humor, to your earlier point, is absolutely the best service of that master. Like, that's Garfield, that's Dilbert, that's the comics that don't necessarily do any character building.
Right.
They are characters in service of the joke, right?
Right.
But to me, a four-panel comic strip is, as much as possible in a comic strip, story-based, character-based comics that are more in service of the characters long form than the story long form. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
Or
and that
more,
also
more, if you, more than the joke long form. Sorry, go ahead.
If you go down that road, then you don't have to make a choice between Gary Larson and Bill Watterson, because then they're kind of doing different things.
Right, right. And so I think what was happening the other day for me when I was going from a 4-panel to a 3-panel and going, this is inherently better, is yeah. I was saying to myself, this is inherently better for the service of the joke, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Not that it was better as a character comic strip, but better for the service of this joke. Because then a 3-panel is setup, setup, punchline, right?
Right.
Bang, bang. It's the standard sitcom format of setup, setup, joke, setup, setup, joke. Like, you watch any kind of Disney sitcom or any kind of sitcom from the 80s, it's always husband walks in, setup, setup, punchline. Wife walks in, setup, setup, punchline. Kids walk in, setup, setup, punchline, right?
Right.
And so that's the standard 3-panel comic strip. But if you want to learn a little bit more about why Opus is insecure or why Calvin likes to go on adventures, you need 4 panels to understand slowly over years why that character does what they do, not just the joke, you know?
Oh, listen, for my kind of writing, I went there and then more so. In other words, what I do now for Evil Inc. is it's half a page, which is technically 2 comic strips.
Right.
It's usually 7 to 9 panels, depending on what's going on. But that's how I write. It allows me to get everything in there that I need to happen to get to that punchline in the 7th or 8th panel. It's just how the writing comes out. I'd love to be able to do it shorter or to change that, but that's not the person I am. And I kind of guess I feel upset about that for a while, but then it's like, okay, who's the better comedian? Dangerfield or George Carlin? Dangerfield is one-liner. I called my girlfriend. She said, come on over. There's nobody home. I went over. There was nobody home. Boom. Right? Then you've got Carlin.
That's a good joke.
Oh, I love that joke. and then you've got George Carlin, and he is more of a monologue person, right? He's going to go in and tell you the 7 words that you can't say on TV. It's going to take him 10 minutes to get through it. You're going to laugh all the way through, but it's a much different thing.
Right.
So when I think about that, it's like, okay, so I'm taking half a page. But if it's satisfying, if it's good, then that's who I am. And at the end of the day, although I'd love to be Charles Adams, maybe I was cut out to be more of this other thing that I am.
Yeah, I think it's apples and oranges. So I think to save earlier us in this conversation, I think it's unfair to compare Charles Adams to Bill Watterson. Yeah. They serve different masters, but I will say this, and this only really occurred to me in the context of the conversation. For Drive, I think I try to accomplish 3 things on a Drive page. So you and I, mainly you, have advocated for years that every comic page, every comic update has to have a satisfying ending. It has to serve a punch moment. And it doesn't always mean a punch line. Right. A comic page, if you're installing by pages, it either has to be a visual that's amazing, a story point that's amazing, a character development that's amazing, a punch that is thrown really well, right? Something like that, right?
Something's got to happen.
Right, something satisfying. And so with Drive, unlike a comic strip, a 3-panel where I serve the joke, or a 4-panel where I serve the joke and I also give you a tiny little slice of a character that over the course of decades will build upon a bigger story, right? I think that's true with Sheldon.
Yeah.
With Drive as a page update, I think I try to do 3 things. I think I try to advance the story in a tiny increment. I try to give you a tiny bit more about a character that you didn't have before you read that page, right? So that's 2 things.
Yep.
And then I try to give you a satisfying ending on that page, whether it be a joke, a punchline, explosion, a punch thrown. I think a 3-panel, a 4-panel, and a page, depending on the size, you can increase what goals you have to get at the end of that creation.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Like
that
a single
makes perfect
panel.
Sense.
A single panel is pure concept. A 3-panel is the service of a joke. A 4-panel is service of the joke, but also a tiny bit of character advancement, right? Like like now you know a little bit more about this world this comic strip exists. And then a page has to serve 2, 3, 4, or 5 goals in that process of creation. What do you think? I would like to hear your thoughts.
No, I agree with you 100%. And I also think that sometimes, like if you're doing a comic strip and it's just not landing, and you know deep down that it's not because you keep getting crickets when you put it out, or you get a lot of I don't get it, and you're like, I just can't do this. Give yourself the latitude to do something that is longer, like an update in half page or full page installments like Dave is doing, give yourself that latitude. You're not locked in. I've been saying this for years now. So many people who are doing comic strips should not be doing comic strips. They should give it over entirely to long form and right. be doing half page or full page updates because they are not, they're just struggling so much.
Right. But like they've already got both feet in the pool. Just dive in. Like, you know, yeah, just get wet. It. Just get wet. Yeah.
Just do it because you see them struggling so much to make that four panel update work. And that's not the web that exists anymore. We don't need to have four panel strips to serve ads because most of us aren't making significant money from ads. Your people that are reading it have a different way of interacting with it. They're not coming to the site. They're seeing it on social media instead. You've got a different, you've got a completely different ball game. There's so many people, Dave, that are doing comic strips that need to just switch it over to long form entirely. And I think they would do so much better.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting, and part of that is the maturity that comes only with time and practice about knowing what format is best. Like if I tried to do Drive as a comic strip, and I could have, if I had to switch it up now, I could have, but God, it would have been unsatisfying, Brad.
Yeah,
it would have felt like. I mean, one of the reasons why everyone makes fun of Spider-Man the comic strip is because in that newspaper format, every week. Or every day, rather, was the same thing. The first panel recapped what the entire last comic strip was.
Yeah.
The middle comic was a tiny advancement of story, like literally micro movement, right? And then the third panel was, and here's a foretaste of what you'll see tomorrow. And it was like so unsatisfying for what a Spider-Man should be.
And you just proved your point because that was a three-panel comic.
Right. Right. The format did not serve what that was trying to
do
at all.
Exactly. That goes back to your point about, you know, serving different masters. In that respect, that comic maybe would have been better as a four panel comic, right?
You know what or they might want to have considered, maybe they could have made like a comic book out of Spider-Man and had Spider-Man in a comic book. That would have been
could
a very
have done full page updates and then put them out once a month.
No, I was jokingly saying they should have made a comic book about Spider-Man. God damn it, Brad, they did have a comic book. They still do. They have 15 titles.
Well, for the next couple of months they do.
Oh God, we're back on that again. We would both agree that like it just inherently it didn't serve that format, and the format did not serve what it was trying to do. You can't tell a Spider-Man story in three panels. It was just it was painful to watch.
It was awkward.
Also, the other one that's like that is the Mark Trail is like it tries to tell a story in those few panels. And then interspersed with it is like a super hyper zoom of a deer that looks like the voice bubble is talking or is coming from the deer. And you're like, what's happening?
What just happened here?
By the way, if you have not done it, there's some old Live Journal or Tumblr post where someone took all the interstitial panel of Mark Trail where the voice bubbles look like the goose that's flying off is talking or the deer that's in the swamp is talking. And it's amazing. Chef's kiss. It's so good.
Oh, that's still that's got to exist out there somewhere.
It's got to exist anywhere.
Well, listen, Dave, we've been kind of chatting comics so much, we haven't gotten a chance to do a single Patreon backer question, and I feel guilty. So in the time remaining, I've got one that I'd like to pitch to you. What do you think?
Yeah, let's do it.
So here's coming in from George Mackay, who says, hey, guys, let's say you're promoting your Patreon rewards on social media, and you get comments from people saying, ooh, that's nice. Is it too direct or out of bounds to ask them specifically and directly to join? How would you guys go about that, if at all?
Well, let me see if I understand this question. So I, Dave Kellett, have made a post like saying, join Drive right now on Patreon and get exclusives and sneak peeks and art giveaways, right? And then someone goes, ooh, that's nice. And they're saying, what do I do next? Is that what the question is?
They're saying, they're not saying, what do I do next? They're saying, what I want to do is saying, hey, you should join a Patreon and then you'd see this more often.
Well, maybe I'm underthinking this, but my reaction is, what you should say is, you should join. You should join Patreon. It's one of the best things I do. Right. I think there's nothing wrong with that.
Now, I'm going to come back to you. This reader's never going to say it, but here's what they're thinking. Why should I pay for it? You just gave it to me for free. And that's what I'm commenting on.
In this context, I'm saying like, hey, gang, you should join Drive on Patreon because you get sneak peeks, you get early reads, you get exclusives, and you get art giveaways, right?
Right.
And by the way, Brad, that's over at patreon.com/drive.
You were going to slip in at some point today, weren't you?
Talk about thirst trap. Talk about thirsty. All right. No, but so if someone says, oh, that all sounds cool, yeah. I don't see what the problem is saying, yeah, it's one of the best things I do. You should absolutely join. You're saying don't do that is what you're saying?
I don't know. So here's the deal. I'm going to say you can do that. I don't think it's going to be very successful.
Okay.
In other words, I think the way that you convert those people is to do something along the lines of what I've said in the past, and that is to continually talk about this party that you've got going on over at Patreon. That person, if they continue to have a favorable response to what you're posting, eventually is going to make it over there. If you push, they're going to dig their heels in and say, I don't want to, right? But if you continually talk about the great time you're having over at Patreon, eventually that person who's already expressed an interest is going to join. Because listen, if you've been doing this social media outright correctly in the first place, they know all of the elements. They know that you're doing stuff there. They know that they can see it if they join. They know that they have to pay if they join. They know all of the variables. They're not missing any information. So if you push them, you risk having them dig their heels in. My opinion, and I could be wrong about this, my opinion is you know you've got that person's attention. Now, you can either push them and risk that they're going to resist you, or you just keep sending that same message out and various messages like it. And eventually, you know that person, you got their attention. You know, eventually, if you're doing stuff that they want to see on Patreon, in other words, like I said earlier, if they're seeing everything, they've got no reason to join on Patreon other than straight up, they want to support you, which is great, but you've got to play the numbers game there. Otherwise, you just keep repeating that message. Remember, you got to hear it 7 or 8 times before you act on it. Keep repeating it. They know the variables. If they're going to join, they're going to join. What do you think?
I mean, I neither agree nor disagree with you. I guess I just don't have strong feelings about this. A part of it, a big part of this is know who you are as a communicator and know what you're comfortable with, right? But then also a big part of this for me is read the room. If they're coming at you enthusiastic, I personally don't have any problems with a little bit of confidence to say, no, my comics are really good. Yeah, you should jump in on Patreon. It's really, it's a fun thing that we got going on over there. You're saying that you feel like that's a pull technique that would make them dig in their heels. So like, no, you're not going to pull me in. I personally feel like they're kind of saying, give me the reason to say, one more reason to say yes, because it sounds really good. So, and I can see both of us being right, but that's why I say read the room, know who you are, get a sense of who they are from past comments and tweets, and then go from there. I don't see either of us going wrong in our approaches. I can see your approach working. I can see my approach working, but go ahead, Brad. What are you going to say?
Here's my thought. Maybe what that means as I'm working this through with you, maybe what that means is you need something in your back pocket to pull out to entice that person to join. In other words, not this person DMs you and says, oh, that's really cool. Instead of saying, yes, you should join my Patreon, what you might want to have in your back pocket is a special sign-up bonus or a special thing that you've got in your back pocket that you don't necessarily, you can promote it, obviously, you wouldn't want to have it and not promote it. But have this thing that a new person gets on the first time they sign up, and you can say, yeah, and I want to let you know when you first sign up, you get this extra thing. What do you think about that?
So here's where I think Patreon has gone really right with the special offer.
Yeah.
So right now, if I have my timing right, based on when this show is coming out, right now, over at patreon.com/drive, I'm doing a special
offer.
Talk
about thirsty!
I know, but listen, but it's important to the conversation. Yeah. So over on Drive's Patreon right now, I'm doing a special offer where they get 4 ebooks if they sign up at the $5 level. And the ebooks are, we can talk about that, it doesn't matter. But anyway, they're 4 ebooks. And what that does to me is it gives me an excuse to say one more time to that person, no, this Patreon really is cool. And right now, if you take action on the inclination that you're clearly feeling based on your tweet response, you'll get XYZ, right? And so what Brad's saying is maybe make that more a more permanent but quiet thing that you have where you go like, yeah, I didn't mention it publicly, but I also have this if you sign up right now, right? Is that a version of what you're saying, Brad? Do I
kind
have that
of,
right?
Yeah, like even if you had like a previous special offer that, because special offers are usually you've got to jump in by the deadline or else you miss it.
Right.
To have something like that in your back pocket where you say, oh yeah, and if you sign up today, I'll send you this thing. In other words, I don't even know that you need to let them know that it's unofficial. You just like you can present it to them like, yeah, if you sign up, you get this thing. They're looking at that. They're like, well, maybe everybody gets it, but it doesn't matter. The important thing is you've got it ready to knock them off the fence.
Yeah, I think, yes, that's true. I guess one of the reasons why at the beginning when I was saying I'm neither here nor there on your response or my response is that I can see both of them working for different kinds of personalities. And so Brad saying continue to put out good work, continue to share that good work with sneak peeks and little snippets on Twitter and social media.
Yeah.
And I'm saying when somebody responds to those snippets and those shared bits of work, it's perfectly acceptable to respond and say, hey, I saw you notice this. I do think it's great. You should jump in on Patreon. I guess what I'm saying is this is not a hill I want to die on. I think both of our ways could work, right?
Here's my only worry about that. The original tweet was Dave Kellett's drive, patreon.com/drive. And then
Where was it again?
Patreon.com/drive.
Okay, that's patreon.com/drive. Okay, yes, okay. I got three out of that.
It's up to five now. The original tweet had the URL in it. Then they comment on it. Hey, I really like that. You're going to comment with that URL a second time?
No. What I'm saying is, Brad, you and I are standing in the ordering area of a Dairy Queen. You have the whole menu right in front of you, right? Mm-hmm. You see the photo of a blizzard and you're like, oh boy, that blizzard looks good. But then I, as a trusted friend, go, Brad, you really should get that blizzard. It's quite exceptional.
Yeah.
That's all it takes to nudge you over getting your wallet out, right? So what I'm saying is in this moment, I, a trusted interlocutor, come in and go, no, Drive is really good and this Patreon is really good. I think you should do it. It's just the nudge to get them over the edge is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
in this situation, the blizzard is the comic and Dairy Queen is Patreon and this metaphor is breaking down.
Oh, my God. And unfortunately, I'm lactose intolerant, so I'm going to stay away from all of it.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think we've given a lot of advice. I don't know that whether there's a clear view.
I know there's not because I really don't. I honestly feel like it's a read the room situation. Like, is this someone you've interacted with a lot on Twitter? Then you know how to play it. Is this someone new you've never heard of before? Then maybe go Brad's route and don't be so thirsty. You know, because if they're new to you and new to the comic, be like, hey, I just found Drive online. I'm really enjoying it so far. I don't immediately go, well, you better join Patreon because it's really good. I go, hey, thanks so much for reading. There's X number of hundreds of comics in the archive. I hope you enjoy it. You know, that it's fun to see you going through the archives, whatever it is. I don't go Johnny Hardsell right away, Brad. Right. You know me well enough about that. What I'm saying is read the room. If there's someone that's interacted with you dozens of times on Twitter or social media, then it's perfectly acceptable to go like, no, there's really some cool stuff on Patreon. You should try it out. But if they're new to you or if they're clearly just dipping a toe into reaching out to you, that's not the time to be like, have you bought every book I've ever made? You should buy them all.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing.
I think read the room is the key words right there. And I'm reading the room right now. And I know that it's time to read the outro.
All right.
You've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Brad, you revealed how the sausage is made. I want people to think that we just say this right off the cuff every week. Now they know there's a script. And that's Brad, you've ruined it. You've ruined it. Your hosts have been my friend Brad Geiger, who apparently pulls back the curtain on the Wizard of Oz like the small dog, the editor of webcomics.com and the cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
and my friend, dentist-loving Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped and cartoonist of Sheldon at SheldonComics.com and Drive at DriveComic.com. You can also join the Drive Patreon at Patreon.com/Drive.
Oh, boy, he earned a lot of friendship points right there. This week's Comic Lab and all the weeks behind and in front of us are sponsored by the good folks at Wacom over at WACOM.com and makers of the new Wacom One. We thank them. And the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. Great music for quarantine, by the way, theworldrecord.net. And this episode was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions over at www.woodsong.media.
Oh, and Dave, if you love Comic Lab, you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, and you may hear your review featured on a future episode like this one. I got to read this, Dave. Have you seen this?
Oh, no.
This came in on Twitter from somebody called, I think it's pronounced Alex McWhorter. Listen to this. So I've been listening to Comic Lab podcast every single week. I started back in October, and I've made it all the way through the archives. And I've got to say, when I jumped in, it felt like a rough Rhett and Link. You know who Rhett and Link are?
I don't.
I'll look them up, and then you can find out that this isn't going so well yet.
It's not a
there's more
okay.
to come.
Okay.
But this is. But he says this is legitimately the best podcast I've ever heard. Between Geiger having such a hearty, egg-filled laugh.
Egg-filled laugh?
An egg-filled laugh.
Wait,
I've never
what?
Heard
Can
that I, before,
what does
but
that
I
mean?
Love it.
Egg-filled, what an egg-filled laugh.
I've looked it up on my in like idiom dictionaries and stuff. I've never seen, if you look up egg-filled, all you're going to get is recipes. There's no... There's no egg filled out there, but between somebody out there is going to be able to tell me where that idiom comes from.
That's got to be like some weird localism, like it's Welsh or it's Irish or it's Scottish or something. There's no way, because I've never heard egg filled laugh. What
it's
the hell
egg filled. Between his hearty egg filled laugh or Kellett trying to be sincere while maintaining his honest opinion as a beginning artist, this has become one of the best things I've ever discovered. Trying to, by the way, I like how you're trying to maintain your sincerity. While keeping your honest opinion.
That's so funny, because that's basically saying Dave's trying to be a nice guy, but he's an SOB deep down. I mean, he's clearly
keeps falling
trying to
on
be
his
nice.
Face.
Yeah.
These guys give so much great advice. I've been able to grow drawing by drawing. This is a great podcast, whether you're looking for comics advice or just a good time. And yes, definitely go through the old episodes. You will never regret it. Comic advice and good chuckles at their peak.
That's amazing. And now
Thank
I want to refer
the...
to you. Now I want to refer to you all the time, Brad, as being egg-filled.
Egg-filled laugh.
Well, now, without knowing what that idiom means, let's try to deconstruct this from a language perspective. I bet it means like the warm, good feelings of like eating an egg, like a well-cooked egg, right? What do you think an egg-filled laughter means?
I thought it meant I cackle like a hen.
Oh, egg-filled laughter. Yeah, that's a Brad laugh.
Yeah, like it
shit,
sounds like
Brad.
I'm a hen that's cackling. I've been accused of cackling before.
You, Brad Geiger, figured it out. That's what egg-filled means. That you sound like a chicken clucking
like
all the
a
time.
Hen. Yeah,
that's not only that's scientifically accurate. You do sound like a chicken.
I guess I've got to own up to it. My own chickenhood.
My little hen. And so on that final note, with huge thanks for those kind words, and that is legitimately super kind words. Thank you for that. I'm going to say Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So I'm going to go ahead and say that with a little egg-filled laughter. Patreon.com/comiclab.
I don't sound like that.
So, Brad, if your laughter is egg-filled, what does Brad Geiger coitus sound like? If that is...
oh, my.
Is that the same sound? Is that what... Was that where like... Hurrah! Huzzah!
It actually does, and then followed by about 5 minutes of groveling.
Groveling?
Just a bunch of apologies. Oh, listen, I'm really sorry about that. I don't know what came over me.
A bunch of apologies. What a great wedding night.
Oh.